You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT. Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us. Welcome to Radio MMT. How are you this week, Anne?
Oh, good, Kevin. I've had enough time off to feel quite relaxed about everything.
We haven't been on the airways together for quite some time because you've been reorganising your brain, resetting?
I've been resetting.
Defragging, we call it?
Yeah, I guess if computers are people and vice versa. If people are computers, sure. But you know what ends up happening when I take a break, Kevin?
What?
Well, I end up like just consuming all this media, like independent media and legacy media and, you know, all the pundits that are out there. Yep. And I just end up wanting to have a radio show so that I can yell back at them.
Yeah, well, do you know what I've been doing? Whilst you've been absorbing media, I've just taken myself off Facebook. I'm no longer on Instagram because it was – I think I've been talking a bit about this just quite recently. It just messes with my head. And I think if we're going to fight the system, we need to keep our brains relatively at a level of stress that makes us still functioning. And I think too much exposure to – all the stuff that's going on, especially with the likes of Trump and One Nation and you know, Pauline Hanson. You can read all this stuff and the disintegration of the coalition. It gets too much, and it doesn't change anything. You just watch it and you slowly lose your brain.
Well, that's true. You can just skim the headlines and keep your sanity.
Yeah. Anyway, look, I hope you've had a good time relaxing. Now, whilst you've been away, and I've been interviewing Bill Mitchell. You probably have not listened to any of the shows, and you probably don't care about what's going on. However, we've been discussing the origins of money. We're going to start MMT from scratch at the beginning of this year.
Going back to the beginning.
And I thought, who better to inform us and get us started than Bill Mitchell, Professor Bill Mitchell.
Fantastic.
And he gave a nice interview, which we're going to continue this week, the last part of it. And we've been talking about, you know, where does money come from? And there's this whole misconception that the private markets create money and drive the economy. That's the kind of the rhetoric we hear all the time.
I used to believe it.
But what we've been discussing is that all money in the economy is created by the government. The banks are involved in that, but the banks do that in coordination with the government. If the government wasn't there, the banks couldn't be lending. Uh-huh. So, and we'll get to banking, right? Mm. But all money in the Australian economy, all Australian dollars, can only be in existence if the Australian government lets it be so. True?
True.
Right. So that means that money is created by the government. It's helped by the banks. They create credit. We'll get onto that. Mm. And not by the private sector. The private sector uses the money. They don't make the money. They use the money. They hoard the money.
Yes. And we're talking about the federal government, not state or local governments.
Yeah, I know. Although the federal government could, you know, they do have an arrangement where they can make grants to the states. And I think that's something we should talk about in the future, the relationship between the states and the federal government, because it's important. For them to perform the works that they're doing. And have a look, everybody's raving on about the Victorian government being, you know, horribly in debt at the moment. Well, all they're doing is spending money on building bridges and tunnels and rail and all that sort of
and
stuff.
And who could bail them out at a drop of a hat?
Yeah, you know, so there's obviously a relationship there which we could get it into further in the future.
But we're doing MMT basics.
We are. So we're starting with money creation, and that comes down to the fiscal capacity of the government to spend money into the existence. We've had a look at things like the surpluses run by the Howard and Costello governments in the late 90s, early 2000s, and the consequences of the government running a surplus, how the economy contracts, and that contraction was covered by private citizens borrowing, using bank credit instead of available money that the government spent into existence. We then had a look to see what the response from the Rudd government after that was, with Wayne Swan as treasurer, and how they spent like drunken sailors. And in so doing, stopped Australia from copping the worst of it, as happened overseas in Europe and America and elsewhere.
They're not lauded for that, are they?
No, no. But I was surprised. He was. He's not often, complimentary of governments and the way they operate, but he put it in a very good broad perspective. He said that they did an outstanding job of saving our economy from falling into recession. He also talked a lot about Japan. Bill loves Japan. The Japanese government is not scared of their fiscal capacity. They spend they spend a lot of money compared to their GDP. What's it, the government debt to GDP ratio?
Yes,
is like 250%. It's and their economy, you know, still exists.
Like, they don't bow to the sort of the Western pressures for everyone to, you know, to look at their debt to GDP ratios and so on.
Yeah,
like they're doing their own thing a bit there in Japan.
Like, they have the same economic structure as Western economies, which is to say they have a, you know, a federal
central
government
bank
that creates the currency, and they trade with the Western economies, but they seem to have a higher regard for their social contract in Japan, and that cultural difference is reflected in their economic management, so they're a very interesting case, and Bill is very much involved over there in the academia advising government, which is, you know, a pretty good role.
So where are we headed to next with Bill then?
Well, the last thing I asked Bill, and I'm going to replay a part of the interview I did with him, which was in the last show that we did, only because it kind of gets interesting. And I asked Bill about what would happen if governments understood their fiscal capacity, and if people were aware that if governments can create money on demand so long as the resources are available for them to spend that money on. This is the crucial thing, and this is the you know, where we start with MMT. The government creates the currency. Doesn't mean they can spend irresponsibly. They have to match real resources with the currency that they create. If they mismatch that, you're going to have all sorts of economic problems. If they run austerity programs, you're going to have hardship. If they chase things which are in short supply, you're going to have inflation. You know, so it's not a it doesn't mean you can just go and spend willy-nilly. You have to be aware of how you spend, what you should be spending on, and what's available, and do. That's what economics is about. This is what we're talking about.
So in MMT jargon, there's no financial constraint, but there is a real resource constraint.
Well, this is what economics is. It's about the distribution of resources in a community, in an economy, and we use money to do that. And the whole question is, like, what's gone wrong, you know, and this is very much part of my thought at the moment, is all the emphasis is on the money and not the resources.
Right.
And you know, capitalism in particular is seems to be more focused on collecting money than it is about the proper distribution of real resources to its citizens. But we can talk about that afterwards. But let's start this week's show by heading back to the interview with Bill Mitchell, and we'll pick it up afterwards from there.
3CR. Here to stay.
It's understood that government spending is restricted by its tax revenue. Therefore, we need an industrious, and we need rich people and successful companies to provide activity so that there's a tax base so that governments can perform. It builds a kind of a dependence or reliance on wealth and capitalism, because it's seen to be directly connected to government spending. that model, that kind of general understanding, and that is the general understanding of how our economy works. You ask, you know, most people, they think that the government's ability to spend is restricted on its tax revenue. If most people understood that a government is not restricted by its tax revenue, that it is the creator of the currency, and that it doesn't need to rely on capitalism or wealth to function, this could be a very different world, Bill.
Well, I mean, obviously it would be a different world if we hadn't been victims of the fiction that my profession creates. And, you know, the world that we think we live in is not the way it operates at all. The world that we think we live in constrains the choices that governments can politically have. Our perception of what the capacity of the government becomes much more limited. The logic is there, it's quite clear.
Yeah.
But it's a fiction. And once you get beyond that fiction, you understand that the capacity of the government is much greater than we think. It's the opportunity set, you know, what it can do and what choices it has available to it are much wider. If we understood that, then the political debate would be very different. What the sort of questions we'd ask of our politicians would be different, and what we would be prepared to accept as answers would be very different. The world would be dealing with the climate issue.
Yeah, and with some greater priority because...
Well, probably effectively.
We're constantly told we can't afford to do these things.
We can't afford this. How are you going to pay for it? Well, yeah. Once we get beyond those sort of questions and ask different questions, the opportunity set that the government has, the available opportunities to do good and bad are much wider.
You're constantly travelling around the world. You've just come back from Japan. You're heading off speaking to different economic forums around the place. What's your feeling with the with the status quo, with the economic orthodoxy?
More people are starting to understand and cut through that sort of fiction in the world. And there's too many examples that have created what psychologists call cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
So cognitive dissonance is when the facts don't fit what you think. And you know, we had the GFC, the big intervention, the bailouts of all the banks and trillions of dollars just being created with a stroke of a pen.
Yeah.
Well, that you know, and you've got the central bank governor in the US at the time saying, well, it didn't come from tax revenue. It came from a computer stroke.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's cognitive dissonance. Yeah. And then you had the pandemic when suddenly you've got total meltdown of everything, yet people's incomes being saved. Well, how? Because yeah. The government's sending them a check.
But there was a glimmer of hope through COVID that this analysis, the MMT analysis of the economy, might be strengthened because it was there right in front of us.
Well, I thought it would happen during the GFC, but I was wrong then.
You know, we've got dissonance now with the environment, with the poly crisis, where we have many, many issues that are to our detriment, to the world's detriment, to the entire system's detriment, because of the way neoliberalism in particular and capitalism is functioning, where things are just getting harder and harder, and yet we still, as a species, are unable to approach it with the right attitude because of this dissonance, this disconnect.
Yeah, I mean, there's vested interests. And those vested interests have a incentive to promote this fiction because it works for them.
In the short term. You know,
absolutely.
Just can we organise? You know, the rest of us, which is the majority of us, to see that this is not good. That it needs to be addressed. I guess I'm speaking about the revolution, Bill. Is it going to happen, or is climate change going to get us first?
Well, look, I'm not an expert on any of that. What I appreciate from experience is that social systems move very slowly. They normally need a rupture to create change. So it's like what we said at the beginning. Japan needs a major shock, a rupture,
yeah,
to get it out of its pessimism. And social systems take too long unless there's a rupture. Humans don't embrace change rapidly. And
so if we have a major ice shelf in the Antarctic suddenly melt and sea levels rise by 2 or 3 metres, that might get people thinking.
We need a catastrophe now. Yeah. You know, the increasing severity of the weather systems and bushfires and floods. You know, Australia, right as we're speaking, has got major floodings in the north.
Yeah, bushfires
down
here.
Bushfires in the south.
But again, it's incremental. Like we've people and the sceptics use this. They say, oh, we've had bushfires and floods and heat waves and all this sort of stuff in the past, and this is just, you know, a progression on that.
Yeah, but they're getting more severe. They're getting more frequent. We've now got in the mid-latitudes this so-called sudden stratospheric warming that's led to major warming above in the stratosphere above Antarctica. It's a polar effect, which has pushed all the cold air to the mid-latitudes and the strong winds. So, you know, we're seeing major shifts that typically would be very rare. We're seeing them with increasing frequency.
Yeah, now that's caused a bit of a cold blast in the not so southern area, in the north of the southern area, and straight away you can hear the climate change denialists saying that, oh, you're talking about global warming, things are getting colder, and they'll use this kind of argument all the time.
Yeah, I mean, global warming doesn't mean that some regions are not going to get colder.
No,
and you know, I mean, anyone who's lived in Victoria this last winter will know that the winter was very windy, and that was because the westerly winds were pushed to the mid-latitudes from Antarctica because of this very rare event that's occurring and increasingly occurring. So, and the cold air was pushed up.
It's the trends over decades, as opposed to there might have been a cold summer in 1923, but it's the pattern.
And it's the interlinked of these weather effects, it's undeniable to me. I'm an economist. I'm not a climate scientist, but I read. I'm trained to read scientific literature,
right?
And therefore appreciate it.
Yep.
So someone else's research, you can understand it. And it's undeniable that this is becoming catastrophic. I mean, it's quite clear we're currently up to about 1.7 times using the regenerative capacity of the Earth.
Definitely unsustainable.
It's totally unsustainable because biological systems die, and that's what we're going to see increasingly. So the question you raise is, you know, I don't think society can change quickly enough. We need intervention to do it. We need a major intervention to do it. And I would look to government to do that.
Well, if we look to the private sector to intervene to fix the problem that they largely have created, and they've created that with government acquiescence, what's the word for it?
They're aided and abetted by governments
who have bent over and accommodated the profit motive over everything else.
It's not just the corporate sector that's complicit. You and I are complicit through our consumption tendencies. Marx talked about the opiate of the masses.
Yep.
And the opiate of the masses since the 1950s has been mass consumption. The capitalist system has sort of mollified us by providing us with a continual stream of consumption goods that U-Butte, G-Wiz type new innovations and things that are so complex now you don't use all the features but they're status symbols.
Yeah.
And that's part of the problem. We have to, as consumers, dramatically alter our perception of what our lives are as well.
I suppose this does come down to human nature. Are we followers? Do people act en masse? Are they influenced by their peers, or are they capable of more independent thought than that? Because that argument kind of privatizes the responsibility for a lot of the stuff when the environment for this mass consumption, this thoughtless consumption, is carefully thought out in marketing terms to make us compliant. And so, yeah, there might be a responsibility of the individual, but I would say that the governments and the corporations that create an environment for mass consumption to occur without identifying the consequences.
No, I mean, it was a strategy. I mean, the capitalist system was under deep threat in the 1920s and the 1930s. Then the war came along, and the capitalist system had to work out a way to shut us up, because us were starting to rebel. And certainly in some countries, us did rebel and overthrew the capitalist system. So the capitalist system had to work out a way to mollify us and to keep us on side. And the way they because increasingly workers were waking up to the fact that they were being deeply exploited by the profit sector, and that there was an alternative way that they could continue to have material security without that. And so the mollification occurred through mass consumption. It's not saying that the household sector was party to all of that. What it's saying is that if you want to solve the problem, then the household sector too will have to have massively different consumption patterns. Now, then you extrapolate that and you're now into a discussion about, is the capitalist system compatible with environmental sustainability? Can we get that 1.7 down to 1, in other words, to be sustainable with the regenerative capacity of the natural system? Can we do that within capitalism? My answer is no, we can't, because the logic of capitalism is ever-increasing growth so that they can have ever-increasing accumulation of capital through profits. That's what capitalism is.
Yep.
It's capital accumulation.
The irony of this is they talk about equilibrium in the conventional capitalist model, but there is no such thing as equilibrium. It's always about profit. The objective of
logic
capitalism.
Of capitalism is accumulation of capital through ever-increasing profit. And the logic of getting it down to 1.7 or 1.8 or whatever it is at the moment to 1 is a degrowth philosophy.
And it means not exponential growth, but continuous degrowth until we reach that target.
Absolutely, and that requires massive changes in consumption patterns. It requires massive shifts in the way we produce and what we produce, and that can only be engineered initially through governments.
And it would have to be regulated and controlled by governments.
Absolutely,
enforced by governments. You'd have to have your whole legal system come in behind it to penalise people that continued to exploit the world, and that is such a different mindset to where we're at the moment.
The conventional wisdom now is that we can achieve steps towards that direction through using the market system, you know, emission trading systems and carbon taxes and things like that.
But if it's based on profit, it's...
Well, it's altering human behaviour through price effects and making things that are pollutive more costly. Therefore, the producers will have to push the prices up and will demand less of them.
Yep.
But the problem is that market systems are corrupted by big players and corporations always. And you just had to see the carbon tax that the Rudd government brought in. The carbon tax exempted one of the largest polluters in Australia, and that was the agricultural sector.
Right, yeah.
And that occurred through vested interests and lobbying in Canberra. So a pure market system's not going to deliver us it. So I've always advocated a rules-based system. And what that means is you go to the Hunter Valley coal producers and you say to them, you've got 10 years to it, and that's it, no more.
Right.
Don't have a carbon tax to reduce the demand for coal. Just say, we don't want coal anymore. In fairness to you and your shareholders, etc., and the communities, we need, say, a decade to generate new employment opportunities in those communities and to get you out. And that's a rules-based approach. It's a dictate. You just say, no more coal in the Hunter Valley.
And those conversations needed to happen, you know, 20, 30 years ago for that to really take effect. We're already across the line. Like you say, we're 170%, 180% of our capacity is being used. The stalling tactics of profit and capital have worked. They've pushed the agenda back decades to the point now where it's probably too late.
Well, this is the question. Are we going to have an environmental Armageddon? And this is beyond my expertise. I just have to listen to what climate scientists say, and they're deeply worried. The 1.7, 1.8 ecological footprint can't go on for very much longer, and already we're seeing the negative effects of it as lay people. In terms of climate, I'm a lay person. I just look at the data, look at what the
continuous bushfires, the worsening floods,
and the research that then examines that, and I say to myself, we're in deep
shit.
Well, I didn't use that word, but we are in it.
3CR, Bill, that's a perfectly acceptable language.
Yeah, but it's also a person who's speaking has acceptable standards as well, independent of the arena they're speaking in.
Fair enough.
Anyway, the point is that I just don't think we're going to make the change quickly enough for what's happening, and I think we're going to have a social rupture. And the problem, human civilization has seen this at regular periods, and it always comes with a conflagration. Some really bad things are happening.
Yeah. Revolutions don't come when people are very happy, do they?
No, I've been doing some research recently on the viability of the food bowls in southern Europe. And there's a process called desertification. The climate is creating new deserts. Now, the question is that it's quite clear that the plant systems in those food bowls, which feed millions of people, are unable to evolve in a biological way quickly enough for the changing temperatures. And what that means is that they die. They just can't cope. So agriculture and the efficiency of farming in those areas, they won't be able to continue. So the question then is, well, where are Europeans going to get its food from? It's fresh vegetables, etc. They will go and seek other places that currently are still able to produce food. Now, how are they going to deal with that? We know that they'll deal with that through military might, because a richer society has better military than a poorer society.
There's a rules-based order in the world, though, Bill. Surely that wouldn't happen in the current circumstances.
Well, we're forecasting major problems, major ructions and war and military, and some of the climate scientists are saying that, from my reading, that human population will have to shrink to 25% of its current to get back to an sustainable ecological footprint.
It's the increase in numbers which is exasperating everything, but we're too smart for our own good. We had a perfect opportunity where we could have culled our population indiscriminately with the recent COVID episode, but we figured out a way around it. So,
well, we did. But, I mean, the general point is that even the progressive elements in this debate won't tackle the major issue, which is excessive population. There's too many humans on the planet.
If we ran our planet efficiently, it's still
too many. It's probably too many humans.
So you reckon a maximum comfortable population would be, what, 6 billion?
I don't know what the actual figure is. I think there's probably too many.
I've mentioned this before on this program, and I'll mention it again now. I did a quick study of human population and found that, on average, with big swings and variations, the human population doubles about every 500 years.
Yeah, the growth rate's too fast at the moment.
Yeah, now, we started with... In 1950, we had about 2.5 billion, and we're expecting 10 billion by 2050. Yeah. That's an increase of our population 10 or 20 times faster
than
normal.
They've all got to be fed. They've all got to have refrigerators.
They're all living longer. They're all eating more. They're all consuming more.
Got to have refrigerators.
Yeah. So the stresses, starting from a 2.5 billion in 1950, back in the day, you're talking about millions, not billions. So the ability to sustain that population, this 8 billion people and growing.
Yeah, it's not sustainable. No. And the problem's the population problem. That's the first problem you have to deal with. But nobody will talk about that anymore, because it gets you into...
Yeah, you're talking about
eugenics.
Culling the human
you're
race.
You're getting into eugenics.
Yeah. Japan has a declining population.
Dramatically declining population.
So they're setting the standard. We need to look at the Asian
countries.
Well,
I've argued this in Japan, that they could actually be the exemplary vehicle to teach us how to degrowth in a sustainable way.
China had a one-child policy for ages.
So not anymore.
Not anymore.
So to me, that's the issue. How are we going to address the population issue? because that's the first step. As well as addressing the shift of production from fossil fuels to non, thirdly, addressing this mass consumption. The mass consumption issue will be dealt with somewhat if we can reduce population growth, but still it needs, within the population, it needs a behavioural shift. They're my takes on all of that. But getting back to the theme of your program, the question is that whatever we can do, it's not a question that the government can't afford to do it. We should be thinking about all these things that should be doing and forgetting about how we're going to pay for it. And what MMT tells us with respect to application to the climate debate, MMT solves the how to pay for it issue. We know that the government has the fiscal capacity, the currency issuing capacity, to do almost anything that it can do if there's a resources available that it can bring into or shift into productive use or, you know, into sustainable use.
So this is the government's job, is to apply its fiscal capacity to make resources available.
Yeah, it's not a question of whether we can afford to do it financially. It's a question of what we do. So, then the questions are quite different.
Yeah.
The questions aren't, oh, we can't afford to do that or that or that. Yes, we can, but do we want to do that or that or that?
What's the correct order? What's the best way of doing this?
So that's an example of how the sort of questions we ask and the answers we're prepared to accept change once you understand the MMT point of view.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Bill. It's been marvellous talking to you. These insights are very useful. Look, thank you very much, Bill.
More than welcome. Thank you. Take care. Good work. Keep up.
Okay, bye. You're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT.
At 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
And wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
Like so many community organisations, we need your continued financial support to keep 3CR on air and our community connected and strong.
Consider selecting Auto Renew for your subscription so your subscription keeps rolling on every year.
We love the security of knowing we have your support into the future.
Head to 3cr.org.au or call 9419 8377 and remember to select recurring for your annual subscription.
You're listening to Radio MMT on 3CR with Anne and Kev. We've just played the last a bit of an interview that I did with Bill Mitchell back in January of 2026 this year, really wanting to drive home the point that the government creates money. It's the currency issuer. And the non-government sector are currency users, and that includes the whole private sector, so that the economy is driven by the government and it is used by the private sector. What are your thoughts, Anne?
Well, it was really interesting. So a lot of what he was saying there was about this lie, I call it a lie, you could call it a myth or this propaganda, that government spending is constrained by tax revenue. So they can only spend as much as they are taxing, otherwise they have to start borrowing. And Bill was kind of saying that this lie benefits vested interests. So I was wondering, in what way is this lie benefiting, say, the elites or the capitalists or whoever you want to talk about? And I was thinking, okay, well, maybe if everyone's believing this lie that the government shouldn't really be spending more than it's taxing, that's a pretty good way to tie the hands of your government. It's a really good way, especially if you've got a democratically elected government. That's a really good way to tie the hands of what people have elected government to do. So
why would you want to tie the hands of government? Who would want to tie the hands of government?
That's the question, right? So you follow the money that's not being spent. I think the first implication of this is that it's a great way to undermine spending on what I would call the public good. So spending on public services, universal basic services, like, for example, in Australia, we still don't have universal dental care. That's one thing. And the other thing I was thinking is that if the government is spending less on things that people need, then who's going to step in to fill that gap? Well, supposedly the private sector. So the more you can convince everyone that the government should not be spending, the more the capitalists can come in and say, we'll do the spending and we'll make some money out of this.
I'm gaining some clarity here. We have the interests of capital saying, leave it to us, we'll provide everything, but they're driven by profit. So you can understand why they want to have control of everything, because the more they have control of, the more profit they make.
Yeah.
And if they're competing against government to provide some services, government is not constrained by profit, because as it's the issuer of the currency, it doesn't need profit. It just needs to distribute the resources fair and equitably amongst the society. Well, fair and equitable doesn't suit the profit motive, does it?
Not only that, but I think there's a certain ideology out there too that we shouldn't have guaranteed housing or guaranteed healthcare. They think people should struggle against each other and the survival of the fittest and all that. So there is an ideology that says we shouldn't have as much government spending as we think we should have. And then, kind of like you were saying, I was thinking it does come back to what that fellow Karl Marx was saying. It's this battle over who owns the means of production. So the less you've got government spending, the more you've got the capitalists in charge of our production.
In our lifetime, Anne, we've seen from the Commonwealth, we've seen the Commonwealth hand over the Commonwealth Bank. Qantas and Telecom have all changed from government hands to private ownership. We've seen at a state level, we've seen gas and electricity, trams and trains shift from being run by the state to private enterprise. We see health and education constantly under pressure from private capital, saying that they can do a better job at running these services with the profit motive than various state and federal governments whose performance is under review every time there's an election. We saw this call that the private sector will provide these services much better and much more efficiently and cheaper than the government sector, because the government sector was racked with inefficiency and all that sort of stuff. Well, we've been running that experiment for decades and the results don't match up with the expectations. The services that are being provided now have this corporate structure, which includes advertising and competition and this top-heavy managerial expenses. Things aren't cheaper. They are definitely not cheaper. And, you know, I would argue that we need to reverse this push to privatisation and get back to public ownership of certainly things like energy, communications, transport, you know, the essential things, you know.
Well, that's exactly what this lie props up. So this lie that the government is constrained by the taxes that it brings in, and we say, of course, that federal taxes do not fund federal government spending. This is the lie that underpins those things like privatisation and then all of the ills that privatisation brings in. So it was kind of, you know, inspiring, and it's a different vision when Bill and you were talking about, you know, what a different world it might be if people understood that federal taxes don't fund federal government spending. I do agree with Bill that raising consciousness about the monetary system is, you know, it's not the whole answer, but I think it is a necessary piece if we're going to try and come up with some kind of post-capitalist economy. And if we ever get there, Kevin, if we ever get to this post-capitalist economy, I personally think we need to understand monetary systems so that, one, we can understand how we keep a monetary system, for example, in an eco-socialist economy, and two, we would understand how important it is to protect your monetary system from exploitation itself. So that would look like you really need to have strong regulation of any kind of finance sector that starts to evolve so that you can prevent the weaponization of the monetary system against the populace.
What's becoming more and more apparent, and Bill said it straight out, he says that capitalism will not solve the poly crisis that we have. We're looking at the environment, we're looking at inequality, a lack of housing, etc. Capitalism cannot solve these problems because capitalism caused these problems. Capitalism is focused on profit, and it uses the natural environment to create profit. Mm. It's exploitative by nature.
It's only a side benefit if it happens to serve the public good.
it's not the motivation at all. So we have to then say that capitalism is causing the problems, and capitalism cannot solve the problems that it's causing. So we have to then figure out, what do we do? Well, the answer is called socialism. This is the reversal of the transition of everything into private hands and bringing it back into state hands, back into government hands.
The collective, basically.
And we've been there before. We were quite, what would you call it, a democratic socialist state far more in the post-war years than we are now, and things worked pretty well. And if they didn't work well, then they needed refining. If we needed to fix things, it wasn't throw it out. We've done that. We've thrown it out. We've privatized everything, and things have gotten worse. Mm. We have to enter degrowth, which means consuming less and winding back those models which are driven by profit. Mm. Well, there's no profit-driven model that's going to agree to degrowth. But that's what we need to do.
Yes.
So capitalism is not going to solve the problem. It's going to make it worse because degrowth doesn't fit its modelling. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And degrowth is something which needs to be controlled, regulated, and coordinated by the state. It's the only organisation that can do it. So we're talking here about openly about socialism, about winding a capitalist, profit-driven economic model back to a state-driven, regulated degrowth model, and the capitalists aren't going to jump on board with that at all.
And I think that's why they're so threatened by these ideas that we understand, Kevin, that the federal government does not get its money from taxpayers, because once you understand that, you realise you don't need the profit-driven model.
I've been getting into socialist literature a bit recently. Yep. They talk about taxing the rich. There's a lot of socialists around who believe that the government is funded by taxation, and when you believe that, you then need an economy that can produce the profit and the market
wealth.
The market driven wealth, so that the taxes can be paid to fund the government. This is a fundamental misunderstanding of how the economy works, and when socialists regard that as the truth, it means that they are relying on profit and capitalism to drive government spending, and it's not the case. So you, all you socialists out there, I'm not starting a fight. I'm asking you to come and let's have a discussion. I could be wrong. If I am, you'll need to explain it to me really well, because I don't think I am.
And so often people will hear too that when we say we don't need to tax the rich for their money, we're not saying we don't need to tax the rich full stop. Yes, we do need to tax the rich. So that's the nuance in here, which is we don't need to tax the rich for their money, but don't get confused and think that we don't need to tax them at all, because we do need to do exactly what Kevin was talking about just now, which is we need to take away their ability to accumulate money, because that's how they get to buy off the political class and decide what the priorities of society are. So we can use taxation to make whatever we don't like unprofitable, or we can just use regulation to make it not happen at all. I mean, obviously, you do need to then be back in control of your government, which we aren't at the moment. The taxation thing is important to do to stop that accumulation. And, you know, Kev, the more I kind of get into this MMT and this economics, the more left I think I become. The thing that's becoming more obvious to me is that accumulation itself, accumulation of money, is a problem, and it's actually probably more of a problem than a benefit. You know, on the one hand, you can say, well, we should let the average Joe, you know, build up some kind of a savings buffer for themselves. So I'm not saying people and regular people can't save. I think that people shouldn't feel like their lives depend on their ability to save, because that's a sort of motivation that creates all these kinds of dysfunction. So people are madly buying up properties left, right and centre so that they feel like they can have a secure retirement.
Well, because things are so insecure that they need to surround themselves with all these buffers. If you buy one property, you buy two, that you buy five, and the next thing you know, there's less property available for other people.
And so that's what drives inequality and these disparities of wealth. So I think we should create security via the provision of universal basic services.
Yes.
And then you wouldn't have people saying, I need $1 million in order to retire. Yeah.
But of course, this is the exact opposite of what how capital operates. Capital likes to create artificial scarcity because scarcity pushes the price up. If there's not enough of something, you can start naming a price. Hey, Anne, I think we need to have a bit of a music break. Here's a track that I found by a mob called Yard Act called Rich.
Almost by accident, I have become rich. Through continued reward for skilled labour in the private sector and a genuine lack of interest in expensive things, it appears I have become rich. And since I have become rich, I've been constantly living in fear of losing everything, that the bubble will burst, and falling from my perch, I will return once again to the life that I used to live with the things that I didn't have before I had become rich. It appears I have become rich.
Rich.
I put a pinch away each week in a place my hand wouldn't fit, so I cannot reach it. It is made of solid steel, a square foot deep with a slit, no bigger than an inch. One day when the seam splits in such a way that it cannot be restitched, I will scratch that insatiable itch and buy the whole hospital and everything in it, because I am rich. It appears I have become rich. You twitching like some headless bird, whilst the witch doctors poach for the stragglers in the herd, pitching the business down on Skid Row. The line goes out the door and you're right at the back. Man, two more poor dead kids in a ditch. I fucking love being rich. It appears I have become so rich. It appears I have become so, so rich. I'm literally drowning in it. But no matter how little I've got, I'll never lose the plot. On top of the hill looking out over the valley, you can see for miles and still get shot. The farmer doesn't want his cows getting what the other cows have got. He keeps his livestock stuffed in his sock. That's why he's rich.
It appears we've both become rich. It appears we're both very, very, very rich. It appears we both got gout. It appears we have no shame. It appears I have become rich. It appears I have become rich.
Lord forgive me, have mercy on my soul, never. No one ever tells you how tough it really is. Please teach me how to be modest and how to be rich. I've done some terrible things because I'm rich. Looking for opportunities in ventures that are bound to bring the silver rain. Sure, it's a rush being cush, but then again, life is a bitch. I've become so rich. And people hate you for it. People really hate you for it.
It appears I have become rich.
You run a real risk being rich.
It appears I have become rich. It appears I have become rich. It appears I have become rich.
You're listening to 3CR
Community Radio.
855 AM.
You're on Radio MMT with Anne and Kev. That was Rich by Yard Act. Not quite sure how I feel about that song. Anyway, I play them. I don't make them. We've been talking about an interview we did with Bill Mitchell a little while ago. Anne, what else was in there?
Another thing there that I heard Bill mention was this idea of cognitive dissonance. That is when you say one thing and do another. The AOFM is that part of Australia's central bank that manages the auctioning of treasury bonds. We in MMT land think is just a smokescreen that confuses everyone, because all this selling of bond makes us think the government's borrowing money.
Yep.
So this is the cognitive dissonance, because they often are doing it within this framework that the government needs to borrow. And of course, the government does not need to borrow money before it spends. So anyway, according to John Kehoe, in an article that was in the Australian Financial Review on February the 11th, 2026, and that article was titled, "This is a real problem. Australia's $1 trillion debt office in chaos."
Ah, boy. Yep.
So if you ever wanted a whole lot of mythology and propaganda in one headline, that's it. So Keogh's telling us that the AOFM, the Australian Office of Financial Management, has been rocked, Kevin. It has been rocked by a series of senior staff departures. And in fact, they have lost 22 of 48 staff in the last few years. And this is amidst complaints about an abrasive management style and excessive international travel.
Do you know what I reckon it is, Anne? I reckon they've been listening to our show and they've all lost faith in their job.
You know, I have been wondering whether the cognitive dissonance is getting to them, or it's really about this poor management that everyone's talking about. You and I, we're not close enough to the action here to really know what's going on. And I've been trying to figure out whether there's been any kind of ideological swing in the economics, and whether that swing would be in a direction that you and I might agree with, and whether that's causing everyone to leave in a huff. So I was wondering, can we read between the lines when John Kehoe is writing, "Another point of tension between Anna Hughes, who is the CEO of the AOFM, and current and former officials, has been the bond issuance strategy for funding the government's escalating debt." So he's making like this technical point here, and he's sort of saying that what they really don't like are these innovative strategies to reduce interest costs for taxpayers, which of course we know is rubbish. And what they also don't like is that the AOFM is borrowing more long-term debt than is needed to fund the government's operations. In other words, they're probably issuing more long-term bonds. And they don't like that the AOFM had an average of $65 billion, with a B, cash balance on deposit at the RBA during 2024-25.
We're talking about quantitative easing? Is that...
Yes. Well, yep. What they're saying is this is tens of billions of dollars more than before COVID. So they don't like any of that. And of course, we know that all of that's irrelevant, right?
Yeah.
But they're taking issue with it. Get this, Kevin. This is a quote that John Kehoe has, which is, "Now the AOFM just has to make sure the money's there when the government needs it. And cost is not even a consideration," a former insider says.
Wow. Okay.
Well, of course. Hello. Cost is never a consideration.
You make the money, guys. You literally make the money. You type it into computers, and that's how it's made. So if the only thing that could stop them from making money is if they sprained their fingers. That's it.
That's right. So I can't tell if the management there is sort of saying, we don't care how much money is sloshing around, because the government can never run out of it.
Like, we've had criticisms of the AOFM before because we thought that they don't know what the whole operation is. You know, you've got one person doing one job, another person doing another job, and they don't really...
Less of them, apparently.
Yeah, but it sounds like they do have an overall ideology, and they're not, and they're sort of thinking, oh, hang on, we're not behaving how we're supposed to. You know, like, imagine if you'd gone through the process of when COVID happened, before then, or even, you know, going back to the Howard and Costello years, where bonds were no longer being issued because surpluses meant that there was no need to issue bonds. Mm-hmm. You go from that to the GFC, like a relatively stable time, then COVID, etc. I mean, you're talking about cognitive dissonance. Mm. If everything that happened didn't marry up with what they expected, and they're trying to do this job and they're supposed to be the experts in the field, well, it would have to mess with your head.
Well, apparently, I looked it up, cognitive dissonance is associated with feelings of unease anxiety and sometimes even shame. So it makes you very uneasy. So you'd be walking around with this terrible pit in your stomach all the time.
Yeah, you're thinking, oh, government debt, when it's not government debt. It's got nothing to do with government debt. All you're doing is issuing bonds, and bonds are part of the financial markets. And we will get onto bonds at some stage through our MMT 101 explanation.
I just thought I'd mention this because the review is happening at the moment. And so part of me is hoping that Anna Hughes has brought in some new economic thinking, but there's a part of me that thinks maybe she hasn't. And the reason for that is because when you look at the terms of reference for this review of the AOFM, unfortunately it reads like business as usual.
Right, yeah.
So interestingly, the review is being led by Guy Debelle. Now, Bill has mentioned in his blog that Guy was once a student of Bill's.
Oh, yeah?
But I don't know. That would have been way back in the day, I imagine. And right. I don't know if any of Bill's heterodox leanings have really rubbed off on Guy.
Right.
But that's an interesting one. And John Kehoe in the Fin Review tells us that Debelle's snap review of the AOFM's structure, governance and capabilities will primarily focus on, and these are the business as usual things, that the AOFM is effectively managing the $993 billion of debt securities, that it's issuing debt at a value for money for taxpayers, and that it is managing financial risks.
Right, yes.
So that's all they're looking at. In other words, they're staying within the neoliberal framework in this review. And so I'm kind of thinking maybe it's not really about a sea change in understanding how the government finances itself.
Doesn't sound like it.
My suspicion is that it's really just a vehicle for getting rid of Anna because she's not playing by the old boys club rules.
And she's called Anna, hasn't got a male name anyway. You know?
No, yeah.
It's not so bad these days. You've got Michelle Bullock and other people who are taken seriously, you know, so yeah.
Well, that's exactly it. So what I was hearing is that Jim Chalmers has been proactively putting women into these senior positions.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that he doesn't know how to get rid of her without looking like an arsehole. I don't know. I read between the lines and I think, yes, this is Jim trying to get rid of Anna without looking like he's being a misogynist, and it's going to be business as usual. And before we go, I did want to mention there is a fantastic group who is trying to get the word out about modern monetary theory and all of the impact that it could have for creating that better society. And that, of course, is Public Money, Public Good. And we know a lot of these people are from Melbourne, but they're going to head to Sydney soon.
We know them because we go to the pub with them once a month, usually on the fourth Friday of each month, which incidentally is tonight. So come and join us at the Bendigo Hotel in Johnson Street, Collingwood.
So anyway, they're heading to Sydney and they're going to be there on Saturday the 14th of March from 12 to 3 p.m. at the Torrens University in one of the lecture rooms, and that's in Surry Hills in New South Wales.
So that's the Torrens University
campus.
Torrens University campus at Surry Hills in New South Wales. When you say March the 14th?
March the 14th. That's right, Saturday afternoon. And so they're going to be running a workshop and it's going to be really nicely interactive. They have a great lineup of speakers and it'll be like being at the pub but without the pub.
Yeah. And these things are, they're small groups. It's free.
It's free.
It's free because, you know, we're economics people and we don't know how to make money.
That's right. We don't get money at all.
No.
Although they certainly do advocate for a real world understanding of money so that we can unapologetically, Kevin, demand the services that we can always pay for.
So that's Public Money, Public Good, March the 14th in Sydney, Surry Hills in Sydney.
On the Torrens University campus. So
Public Money, Public Good, they're on the interweb somewhere?
They're on the interweb. You can look up just their name and you can get tickets from Humanitics.
Excellent. Is that it for us today, Anne?
That's a wrap, Kevin.
We've emptied our brains and
we have.
And shared it with... Until the next show, see you later, Anne.
All right, we'll see you then, Kevin. You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au www.3cr.org.au/radio-mmt.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his mmted.org, educating the masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, yeah, no, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, have you heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable funds theory?
Have you heard of a band called Single Gum Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the...
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.